It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Sorry, I'll be ready in a moment. I was just checking the latest tweets by Elon Musk and the latest posts by Donald Trump on Truth Social, just to make sure I have everything that you need to keep this up to date. Musk, and we'll talk more about him in a moment, posted a picture of his bedside table, and everybody's now analyzing it. It's got a gun on it, 4 or 5 cans of Diet Coke, and a small replica of the famous painting of Washington crossing the Delaware during the Revolutionary War. So we can all now psychoanalyze and so forth. I mean, he has this sort of weird talent for getting people talking, and not to mention, his political posts. And he was on for like a long time, I guess, yesterday, and people were saying, why don't you raise the character limit for Twitter to 1,000, and people can see the first part if they want to click on it to see the longer part. And he would say something like, yes, that's on the to-do list, and people would make suggestions. Oh, I'm working on it. All right, well, that's okay. You know, I bumped into yesterday at Fox was Buzz Bissinger, sports writer, author of Friday Night Lights. I used to work with Buzz, and this is some years ago, and he was always involved in controversy. He was a very excitable guy. He was on Twitter saying all kinds of outrageous things and tweeting about his fourth wife, and his life kind of spun in a certain direction. And then he just dropped off the face of the earth, not seeing him on Twitter, not seeing him anywhere. And now suddenly he's got a new book out. It's called The Mosquito Bowl. And he was pretty subdued when I saw him. I mean, he seemed like he had sort of gotten it together, but he wasn't, jumping up and down. Anyway, it was nice to run into him. Media buzz yesterday. Wow. We had a lot of stuff to cram in. And because it was a bad week for Donald Trump, just objectively speaking, take the politics out of it, take, my views or your views out of it. It was a bad week. And when that happens, I have to cover it. And when that happens, I mean, this was really true yesterday. I mean, I just got eviscerated on Twitter by all these MAGA types, name calling and you should be fired and you suck and all of that. And how about this? And how about Joe Biden's a criminal, whatever, not so much for anything I said, because I was often in the position of pointing out, Trump is entitled to offer his views. Here he is hitting back at the Supreme Court. I mean, look what happened just in the space of 7 days. Supreme Court rules unanimously against him on turning over his tax returns to a Democratic House committee. An appeals court is ready to throw out the ruling on the special master. Mike Pence indicates he might testify to DOJ in front of a grand jury against his former boss. And then comes the dinner. You know what I mean by the dinner. So, of course, we're going to talk about it. Of course, I have to cover it. And, when Trump added defense, I mean, I put it right at the top of the show, talking about the Supreme Court, it was a unanimous ruling against him, including his 3 appointees. And he said, the Supreme Court, shame on the Supreme Court, and always rules against me. And it's become a political body, which is mildly amusing, since Donald Trump tried very hard to turn it into a political body. That is a very conservative body, which it remains on issues, but it doesn't mean that the justices are going to rule for him every time there's a dispute. And this was just a case where the court decided not to step in and overrule a lower court. All right, let me get to story number one, because I got a lot to say about this dinner. And Meghan McCain was on the show yesterday, and she just went off on it. And her comments were, right at the top, even this morning, a day later on Mediaite, where she used it as an example of Donald Trump being unfit for office. That's her opinion. And she talked about, anti-Semitic crimes being rising. I don't know if it was an all-time high, but certainly noticeably increasing. And here's Donald Trump having dinner with Kanye West and Nick Fuentes. Now, again, I tried to provide the context of what Trump said about this, but here's what's not in dispute. Last Tuesday night at Mar-a-Lago, Kanye West showed up to have dinner with Donald Trump, and Trump either invited him or knew he was coming. And, you know, that in itself sends a signal because Kanye West has been spewing anti-Semitic garbage on Twitter and all over the place for many weeks now. He's never apologized or taken it back. So even on that score, and Trump responded that Kanye's a very troubled man, and he was offering him some business advice. Yeah, he's lost most of his business through his own words. But it sends a signal if a guy who has become, unfortunately for him, you know, who's a very popular rapper and entertainer and billionaire, you know, all the stuff about going to DEFCON 1 on the Jewish people, DEFCON 3, excuse me, and all that. So he shows up for dinner. Another person was a woman who worked for Trump in Florida in 2016. And then there's another guy, and Kanye says, this is Nick. Now, Trump put out a series of statements, sort of trying to distance himself from Nick Fuentes. Now, if you're not familiar, Nick Fuentes is a guy who, if not a white supremacist, is certainly a white nationalist, has also spewed a lot of anti-Semitism, has also made a lot of racist comments, is a Holocaust denier. Not someone who you would think a declared candidate for president would want to be associated with. And I got to say, while Trump said two things. One is he didn't know Fuentes was coming. That's entirely possible. And he didn't know anything about Nick Fuentes. I don't know. That seems unlikely, but take him at his word. But once he has dinner with a guy, and clearly there's this huge uproar, you would think that Trump himself, or he would ask one of his aides, to look up a bit about Fuentes and find out who he just dined with. And at the dinner, it's reported by people who were there, including Karen Giorno, the former Florida political director for Trump, that Trump said he liked Fuentes because he got him in their conversation. Again, let's take it at face value. Some guy named Nick, he didn't know the background, didn't know who he was. It would take about 10 seconds to Google the guy. And then Donald Trump could have, rather than just say, I don't know him, I didn't know he was coming, could have put out a statement disagreeing with his notorious anti-Semitic, racist, absolutely offensive and despicable views. But he did not do that. Not even a sentence, not even a phrase. And you know how else has largely been quiet about this? Most Republicans. Couple of exceptions. Chris Christie, obviously, is planning a run for president. Said publicly that this looks awful for Donald Trump. It's clear that some of the people around Trump, his advisors, think this is a catastrophe, are not necessarily surprised by it. And also sort of shows you that, you know, anybody can kind of show up at Mar-a-Lago, maybe not anybody, but somehow have access to Donald Trump. So here's a New York Times story. So Fuentes is 24, and he has ties with people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, two hard right members of Congress. Unabashed racist, according to the Times, uses hateful language on his podcast. In recent weeks, he called for the military to be sent into black neighborhoods and demanded that Jews leave the country. So we're not talking about subtle stuff here, folks. Now, some people, when the story was first breaking, said, no, Fuentes wasn't at the dinner. But he was. And this has been confirmed by multiple people, including Nick Fuentes himself. Oh, here's one of the statements. Kanye West very much wanted to visit Mar-a-Lago. Our dinner meeting was intended to be Kanye and me only, but he arrived with a guest whom I had never met and knew nothing about. Unexpectedly show up with three of his friends. And they're sitting on the back patio at Mar-a-Lago, where I once went, the only time I've been there, to interview Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign. Here is Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League. Nick Fuentes is one of the most prominent and unapologetic anti-Semites in the country. He's a vicious bigot and known Holocaust denier who has been condemned by leading figures from both political parties here, including the RJC, Republican Jewish Coalition. He said the idea that Trump or any serious contender for higher office would meet with him and validate him by sharing a meal and spending time is appalling. And really, you can't say that you oppose hate and break bread with haters. It's that simple. Here's Christie, just another example of the awful lack of judgment from Donald Trump, which, combined with his past poor judgments, make him an untenable general election candidate for the Republican Party in 2024. Now, more background here. I mean, Fuentes was at what turned out to be the violent rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, some 5 years ago. After Trump lost in 2020, Fuentes and company, well, first of all, they were at a Stop the Steal rally in November 2020. He urged his followers to storm every state capital until Inauguration Day the following November, until President Trump is inaugurated for 4 more years. At one event, he was chanting, he had led the crowd in chanting, "Destroy the GOP." Anyway, you kind of get the idea. So here's the kicker. Here's the irony. Fuentes makes his own video and says, look, you know, I didn't mean to cause Donald Trump any public relations problems. I told him that he is one of my heroes, that he is one of the most important people in the planet. But then I told him that it was time for the party to move on and that I, Fuentes, was backing Ron DeSantis. So Trump not only creates a world of trouble for himself by dining with this guy, but he doesn't even have his support. And by the way, you may have heard or seen this, but Kanye West made his own video, a weird kind of video, where he was pissed off because Trump was talking smack about his estranged wife, Kim Kardashian. And he said, wait a minute, that's the mother of my children. And he bleeped out, Kanye bleeped out, whatever it was that was said. So I can't tell you if it was horrible or not, but there you have it.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Story number two, Joe Biden, and whether he's going to run again, since he made some remarks about talking to his family, not necessarily this weekend, this past weekend when he was in Nantucket. Oh, and was asked about Trump's dinner by reporters, and he kind of held his tongue, and finally he said, you don't want to know what I think, and got in the car. But then the White House put out a statement saying, you know, no place in our society for anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial. So the White House is willing to take it on his statement, but Biden, and this is the way he sort of deals with Trump, unless he has a very particular reason, like a midterm campaign of taking him on, he doesn't want to respond to everything Trump says because then you get sucked into the endless back and forth. Okay, so New York Times says that because Democrats did far better than expected in the midterm elections, that this has quieted the Democrats' public expressions of anxiety about Biden's poor approval ratings. Interviews with more than 2 dozen Democratic elected officials and strategists, not that it's up to them, suggest that whatever misgivings the Dems may harbor, the party's more inclined to defer to him than to try to force a frontal clash with a sitting president.
people ranging from Congressman Henry Cuellar, one of the most conservative House Democrats, to Pramila Jayapal of the Squad, and Congressional Black Progressive Caucus, said they would support another Biden bid. In private conversations, younger Democratic operatives have shifted from discussing potential job opportunities in a presidential primary to gaming out what a Biden reelection campaign might look like. And a lot of lawmakers have applauded Biden for the accomplishments that he had in the first 2 years. You know, all those bipartisan bills that gave them something to run on. USA Today poll, 71% of Democrats surveyed believe he can win in 2024, up from 60% back in August, although they're divided on whether he should be the nominee. Now, here's the interesting paragraph. The concerns over Biden's overall weak standing in polls have not dissipated entirely, and some Democrats say the challenges confronting the 80-year-old president and his party should not be glossed over in the party's relief over the outcome of the elections. Segue into Rich Lowry of National Review. Joe Biden 2024 is a bad idea whose time has come. And Lowry acknowledges the things that I was just talking about, you know, greater success than expected, and now the Dems seem to be rallying behind him. But Lowry, it's all about the age. He just turned 80. Every day of his presidency is an experiment in whether he can perform at the level demanded of the office. Democrats consider Biden the safe choice since he's the incumbent, surrounded by flawed alternatives, yet he's actually an enormous risk. So here's the case that Rich lays out. Nominating him would be extremely reckless, both for the party and the country. Not that Lowry necessarily wants a Democratic president elected. He certainly doesn't want Donald Trump, who thinks National Review should die, which they're using in their fundraising, to be elected. Okay, so first, partisan considerations. It may well be that Biden is the best matchup against Donald Trump. He beat him once before, used him as an effective foil during the midterms. It's to Biden's advantage that it's proven difficult for anyone to work up a passionate hatred of him, rather than a low-intensity sense of pity or contempt. That so many hated Hillary Clinton for so long was her ultimate undoing in 2016. This, I think, is actually starting to be acknowledged as a factor. I mean, Biden's been around forever, and even those who think they don't like his politics, they don't like him personally, I mean, he's just not a threatening figure. He's Grandpa Joe at this point. He has a moderate affect and profile, says Lowry. There are limits to how woke an 80-something silver-haired creature of the Democratic establishment can appear. So that's to his benefit. But there's no guarantee Biden will get Trump as his opponent. Former president has a good chance of winning the GOP nomination as anyone, but he's less of a prohibitive favorite. If Biden doesn't get Trump, and here's where the speculation and war gaming gets interesting, then he'll be denied the dynamic of one old guy whose record is terrible, Lowry's view, running against another old guy who frightens people. Age wouldn't be much of a consideration in a Biden-Trump race, Trump being in his late 70s, except for people wondering how we got locked into running such old, deeply flawed candidates, not once but twice. But if Trump doesn't get the nomination, Ron DeSantis is 44, Ted Cruz is 51, Mike Pompeo is 58, Tim Scott is 47. Basically, any Republican nominee beside Trump would instantly get a powerful past versus future theme. That is true. Whatever edge Democrats imagine Biden would have against Trump disappears against DeSantis, a candidate nearly half Biden's age, who hasn't repelled the middle of the country and isn't obsessed with the 2020 election. That's true, too. I would just throw in, as I often do, that DeSantis may be the guy to knock off Trump in the primaries or not. He's untested as a national candidate. He's compiled a record that Republicans like in Florida. He certainly played the culture wars very skillfully. But he's not overflowing with charisma, and we would have to see. But here's the ultimate line from Lowry. Another risk for Democrats. That Biden will experience some age-related meltdown in public during a general election campaign that will make his struggles undeniable, even to well-wishers determined to look the other way. Well, that may or may not happen. Politico piece by Jonathan Martin, who's moved from the New York Times back to Politico, where he used to work. Gavin Newsom wants the world to know he's not going to challenge President Biden in 2024. There have been a lot of chatter about the California governor. He tells Politico, I've told everyone in the White House, from the chief of staff to the first lady. His message to Ron Klain and Jill Biden when he visited Washington was to count him as a firm supporter of Biden's reelection. I'm all in. Count me in, he described telling them. Put me in, coach. So, apparently, there was on election night. Yeah, Newsom told this to President Biden on election night. He was standing outside his motorcade, talking on his cell phone, and who wanders by but Jonathan Martin. The governor didn't intend for me to hear that part of the conversation. I just happened to leave the hotel when he was taking the congratulatory call on the sidewalk with his family at his side. But walking through Sacramento back to the mansion, it was hard not to think of the difference between him and the last two California governors who lived there. 76, Ronald Reagan challenged Jerry Ford. Didn't win, but won in 1980. 4 years later, Jerry Brown challenged Jimmy Carter. But both incumbents would lose the general election, as would George H.W. Bush, the last year a president would face a remotely serious primary. Now, what does Elon Musk say about this? What does Elon Musk say about everything? My preference for 2024 presidency is someone sensible as centrist. I had hoped that would be the case for the Biden administration, but I've been disappointed so far. He also said he's fine with Trump not being back on Twitter. The important thing is that Twitter correct a grave mistake in banning his account, despite no violation of the law in terms of service. Deplatforming a sitting president undermined public trust in Twitter for half of America. Finally, he was asked on Twitter whether or not he would back Ron DeSantis in the next election. Elon Musk responded, yes. All right, number three. And notice how I just kind of slide into this segue for more on Twitter. This is an interesting story in the Washington Post that has a lot of people guessing. And I've heard this chatter from conservatives and Republicans that I know, including Meghan McCain when I chatted with yesterday. High-profile Republican members of Congress gained tens of thousands of Twitter followers in the first few weeks of Elon Musk running the place, while their Democratic counterparts experienced a decline. So, Elizabeth Warren, Adam Schiff, Bernie Sanders all lost about 100 Twitter followers in the first 3 weeks of Musk owning the place. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Jim Jordan gained more than 300,000 followers each. Those are stunning numbers. Now, the Post says, oh, it's difficult to tell why the follower accounts go up and down, sometimes affected by bot accounts. Not everyone who's following these people is a supporter. Sure. The pattern suggests that tens of thousands of liberals may be leaving the site while conservatives are joining or becoming more active. On average, Republicans gained 8,000 followers. Dems lost 4,000, according to this Post analysis. Right-wing and conservative for years have accused Twitter of censorship with no proof, it says. Okay, I think this actually qualifies as some kind of proof. I'm not buying the notion that all hundreds of thousands of Dems have left and hundreds of thousands of Republicans have suddenly joined Twitter and followed these prominent politicians. I think at least part of the explanation, and there may be multiple explanations, is that Republicans and conservatives, some of them, were shadow banned in the sense that they didn't get all the people who wanted to follow them or might ordinarily be expected to follow them because their tweets weren't seen. I think that's what this shows. I could be wrong, but when you look at these numbers, I mean, holy moly. On the very day that Musk's purchase was finalized, Republican members of Congress saw their follower count skyrocket. This is just on one day. Marjorie Taylor Greene up 37,000 followers. This is, you know, a few weeks ago. Jim Jordan also gained that amount. Elizabeth Warren lost 19,000. Adam Schiff lost 13,000. Same thing happened on November 19th when Musk announced he'd be reactivating Trump's account. Green, in that one day, gained 45,000 followers. Warren and Sanders lost more than 22,000. So this is vindicating what a lot of Republicans and conservatives have said, like, wow.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Let me get to number four. This drives me crazy. On yesterday's front page of the Washington Post, stripped across the top, three reporters worked on it, clearly spent a lot of time on it, was what was presented as an exclusive story, long, detailed, reported story about Sam Bankman-Fried, the guy who was the crypto king, who empire has just collapsed, it's gone bankrupt. Billions of people have lost their investments in cryptocurrency because of this guy. We had really what I thought was a great segment on the show. You can look it up, as well as other Media Buzz segments, with Steve Krakauer, who explained a lot of the reasons, how he gave money to liberal causes, how he gave money to media organizations, how he donated, you know, was the second largest donor to Joe Biden and donated another $40 million, $10 million to Biden, $40 million to Democrats. And nobody, the media lionized this guy. Nobody was skeptical. But I could not find it on yesterday's Washington Post homepage. The same day. So it's in the paper. And you scroll down and you scroll down and you scroll down, and this story that they put so much into, nowhere to be found. This happens constantly. Maybe, you know, it got a big ride on Saturday and it gets pushed down, but that's crazy. How do you not showcase your best stuff? So then I searched for Bankman-Fried, couldn't find it. Then I clicked on investigations. You know, you can go to different verticals, couldn't find it. Then I clicked on business. And it was about the fifth story down. So it took a lot of detective work for me to find the story. Anyway, what the story says is that there's this woman who visited when they were all living in this place in the Bahamas. And she was really puzzled. Like, how does this 30-year-old billionaire living in this garden island complex had the world's elite at his beck and call? And he was hobnobbing with Katy Perry, Tom Brady, who did that, who's one of the people who's done publicly vouch for this FTX company. And now he's named in the suit. And I don't think that's fair because, you know, he was paid to do a celebrity endorsement. For one party, VIPs took a boat from the island to a second, even fancier island for a feast of lobster. A private DJ concert, open bar, and she recalled thinking, you're living this lifestyle of poverty, but you're partying with Katy Perry? Okay, fair question. Bankman-Fried put out a letter saying he regretted what happened to all of you. Yeah, they lost their money. Oh, you were my family. I've lost that. Our old home is an empty warehouse. Apparently he's going to call in to CNBC or something in a couple days. He's trying to salvage his reputation, but, you know, not happening. He almost exclusively wore schlubby t-shirts, shorts, and tube socks. Never combed his nest of curly hair. He played video games during conference calls with major investors. And he was candid about using performance-enhancing drugs. He tweeted in 2019 that stimulants when you wake up, sleeping pills when you sleep, in-office naps keeps your mind in work mode. I mean, he's a weird guy, right? Okay, this is the most interesting tidbit. FTX employed people like George Lerner, an in-house psychiatrist and performance coach, who did not respond to requests for comment. He has said in interviews that he helped this group of 20-somethings navigate the stresses of work and isolation in the Bahamas. Part of his job, he said to Vice, involved finding dating options to keep workers feeling happy and fulfilled in their new home. After meeting Lerner at a party, this woman who I quoted said Lerner asked her whether she'd be interested in pursuing something romantic with Bankman-Fried. The whole arrangement struck her as odd. I don't even know what to say about this. They employ this guy as a performance coach, and part of his job is to pimp for Sam Bankman-Fried, to ask women who visit the Bahamas whether they'd like to sleep with the guy? And they didn't need any help because he already had a girlfriend. This woman
who was the CEO of the other company that was involved in bringing the whole thing tumbling down. And the other woman, who was, at least for a time, the girlfriend, Ellison, said in 2020 that she had embraced polyamory, I guess which means everybody gets to sleep with everybody, in the style of an imperial Chinese harem. So, nice life. But the thing about Bankman-Fried is all of this, the donations, the giving to media organizations like ProPublica and Vox and Semaphore, the new global-focused thing in which Ben Smith is a major partner. It's all playing with other people's money. Other people bought cryptocurrency, stored it with FTX. They could have stored it with anybody, but it ended up with FTX. And I don't think they're ever going to get much of their money back. They've lost billions of dollars thanks to this guy. All right, the kicker, number five, involves Bob Dylan, but not really his music. This is fascinating because Bob Dylan generally, as you all know, keeps a low profile. And it has to do with his new book called The Philosophy of Modern Song. Simon & Schuster is the publisher, a book of essays about more than 60 pop songs. And people were offered the opportunity, if they're really big Dylan fans, to buy a special hand-signed edition for $600. Included with each copy was a letter from Jonathan Karp, the CEO of Simon & Schuster, somebody I know and who was involved with one of my books before he attained this lofty status, confirming the signature's authenticity. Except, and you probably know what's coming, the signatures weren't authentic at all. So rather than buying the book, the Dylan book, for $25 or whatever it retails for, people spent $600 and it wasn't a real authentic signature. Suspicious fans began comparing their signed copies on social media and noticed that the signatures all looked exactly the same, which would be a pretty tough feat if Dylan actually signed these 900 or so copies. I mean, I've done a lot of book signings, and, you know, your hand gets tired, and your signature does not look the same in every time. So now Dylan is apologizing. Bob Dylan, in a long message on Facebook, said he suffered from vertigo throughout the pandemic, which, along with coronavirus precautions, made signing so many books a difficult, if not impossible, task. Quote, "I've been made aware there's some controversy about signatures on some of my recent artwork prints and on a limited edition of Philosophy of Modern Song. I've hand-signed each and every art print over the years, and there's never been a problem. However, in 2019, I had a bad case of vertigo, continued into the pandemic. It takes a crew of five working in close quarters with me to help enable these signing sessions, that we could not find a safe and workable way to complete what I needed to do while the virus was raging. It was impossible to sign anything, and the vertigo didn't help. With contractual deadlines looming, the idea of using an auto pen was suggested to me, along with the assurance that this kind of thing is done all the time in the art and literary worlds. Using a machine was an error in judgment, and I want to rectify it immediately. I'm working with Simon & Schuster and my gallery partners to do just that." And Simon & Schuster also posting an apology on Instagram, saying it will provide full refunds to anyone who purchased that special $600 edition. So the Washington Post story on this was full of, like, the answer is blowing in the wind and, you know, different plays on different famous Dylan songs. But I understand Dylan's dilemma, but it's pretty bad. If you know that people are paying, you know, hundreds of dollars basically to get a hand-signed copy, and it's not a hand-signed copy, and you sign off on it and being told, oh, this happens all the time, you look bad, your publisher looks bad, everybody looks bad. A very rare apology, to be sure, from the great singer-songwriter Bob Zimmerman Dylan. And with that, hope you had a great weekend.
As I said, Media Buzz segments online. You can check them out if you were busy with family and Thanksgiving or just traveling over the holiday weekend. Really appreciate your spending this time. I'd be very happy if you'd subscribe. And we'll see you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.